for months and months and months, and they can release a huge amount of carbon that would normally have been stored in the organic layers of the soil. Those are the fires that we also want to call wildfires, because they do very much cause an environmental concern. And we've seen lots of examples in the past where peat fires, particularly in tropical Southeast Asia, have released huge amounts of particulates into the air and created enormous health issues for populations that are impacted by the smoke that's released by that. So I would agree that there are some fires that, while not a direct impact on humans as such in terms of their lives and livelihoods, but they do have impacts either ecologically or in terms of long-term health for many people who are a long, long way from where the fire actually occurred.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
When your team looks at the global map for increasing wildfire danger, what are the hot spots, so to speak, where populations and governments may have to try to adapt to a new fire regime?
There are lots of very specific locations around the world where the modelling that was done in the UK suggested that the threat of wildfires in the future is going to increase significantly. What came out of that analysis was there are some regions that you would not have previously thought were a danger in terms of wildfire. One of these was the Middle East. Another was India, so the subcontinent, and northern Russia, Siberia. So places like that would not have traditionally been thought to have been a wildfire hotspot, say, not like what you'd call Australia or Canada or the US, but they are increasingly being affected by wildfires, and they're happening in those places that don't have a history of dealing with wildfires. So they've got a major hurdle to overcome, not just the impact of the fire itself, but what to do about it. They don't have a history of managing wildfires. So the important thing that came out of the report is that many of these areas that are newly being affected by wildfires can learn a lot from what's been occurring elsewhere in the world. They can also teach other places that have been affected by wildfires. So the true message that comes out of the report is that there are lessons to be learnt by everybody everywhere. There is no single jurisdiction in the world that solved the problem of wildfires. So the important bit is we need to learn about wildfires and learn to live with wildfires, basically. Undertake the steps necessary to reduce the risks as much as possible, but also realise that you cannot reduce that risk to zero. You need to be able to deal with the residual risk of wildfires when they do occur.
Well, trying to understand what fires do, Andrew Sullivan, you developed a kind of fire test tunnel, the Pyrotron. What does that tell us?
So the Pyrotron is a combustion wind tunnel that allows us to study the behaviour of fires burning through bushfire fuels, what we call bushfire fuel. So this is just natural vegetation that we place inside the tunnel, and we can study the mechanisms and processes by which these flames propagate through that natural fuel to get a better understanding of the factors that influence the behaviour of fires and develop better understanding of what steps could be done to try to reduce the impact of those fires.
Firefighters need to know how fast fires will spread. In fact, we all need to know that in order to guide evacuations. How well can experts predict fire speed these days?
Well, I would say we can predict the speed of fires in most vegetation types pretty well. Various places around the world have different ways of doing that. In Australia, we've got what we call fuel-specific fire spread models. So we've got fire spread models for specific fuel types. So we have a grassland fire spread model or a forest fire spread model. And those models, given the nature of fire behaviour and the variability both in terms of the inputs that go into determining a fire and the vagaries of fire combustion itself, we've found that we can predict pretty well, and the measure of pretty well is in the order of about plus or minus 35% of the actual speed. Some of the models do far better than that, and there are some models that struggle, but it's primarily because we don't actually know the conditions in which the fire is burning. So the uncertainties that are involved in the inputs, and the inputs are quite complex. It's the nature of the fuel, and it's the weather that's driving it, and the specific locations about where that fire actually is. So all of those uncertainties mean that the predictions have some uncertain bounds on them, but the nature of the fire is pretty well understood, and I think we've been able to predict fairly well the rate of propagation of wildfires and the direction of propagation of wildfires.
Even though there have been some terrible fires and a lot of video on the news, people do continue to move into the forest interface zone and suburbs spring up among the trees. isn't the fire situation a little like coastal flooding? Death and damage is worse because we move into the danger zone.
It's certainly one of the factors that's increasing fire risk globally, and more generally we would describe that as land use change. So that's both in terms of people moving into areas that were predominantly, you know, at risk from fire, but it's also people moving away from rural areas. So fires that do occur are now getting bigger because there's nobody there to do anything about them. So that dynamic of the change in populations and the use of land is one of the big factors, along with climate change, as to why our fire risk is changing so rapidly and expected to change so significantly by the end of the century.
Speaking of flooding, eastern Australia just went through incredible floods. Here in BC, we had torrential rains and never before seen landslides and floods, along with a big heat dome and the fires. Are there connections between floods and fires?
No, that's not my area of expertise, but it is one of the other sides of the coin, if you will. So the conditions for widespread conflagration fire is extended rainfall deficit, what we call drought, basically. That preconditions the fuel for ignition and makes it difficult for fires to be put out. The flip side of rainfall deficit is increase in the rainfall. And Australia particularly has a long history of a cycle of drought and flooding rains. And there's a very famous poem by Dorothea McCullough called My Country that has that line, a land of drought and flooding rains. We have the extremes of those almost continually. You started off about the word average, and I think that's a good angle to take in that we have droughts and we have flooding rains. The average is something in the middle that is nice, but we don't actually spend a lot of time at the average. We spend a lot of time at either of the extremes. And it's one of those things that in Australia, particularly with the experience I've had, that we will have major fire events like we had in 2019, 2020. And very soon after, there will be a change. And quite often this has been attributed to events like El Nino and La Nina, where we go from the extensive rainfall deficit and droughts across much of the country that can last anywhere between 5-10 years, and then we'll flip into the flooding rains bit, where we will have repeated weather cycles that mean that we have low pressure systems that dump lots and lots of rain over the East Coast. And I'm sure that sort of experience is common in other parts of the world as well.
From another of your past papers, I learned a key thing, I think. When a bushfire is over, it is far from over. Talk to us about the health impacts and ecological damage that continues long after the flames subside.
The interesting thing about fires, in contrast to flood, is that the sphere of influence of a fire is much, much larger than the actual fire itself. So an average fire might burn, not the average fire, but a significant fire might burn 100,000 hectares, say. But the sphere of influence of the effect of that fire could be 10, 100 times that area in terms of people impacted by the smoke that fire generated, the damage that fire has done on the infrastructure that then affects larger populations. The scaling up of the impact of a fire is quite significant in some places. So even a small fire can have a huge impact depending on where it is and what it burns. Floods generally only affect the area where the flood is. It's not one of those phenomena that has a huge knock-on effect. One of the key things that came out of the UNEP report that we recently published was the health costs associated with wildfires, particularly extensive wildfires, is runs up into the billions, where you're getting lots of people who don't even get to see the flames that are significantly affected by the smoke, with cardiovascular issues. And as an example, the 2019-20 fire season in Australia had, I think it was like 33 fatalities in a direct result of the fires, but the fatalities afterwards, as a result of the health impacts from the smoke that was released, it was in the order of 450 to 500 people. And so the cost associated with the second-order health impacts of fires is quite significant. And when you consider places like Indonesia, when they have a delay in the wet season arriving and the peat fires take hold, it can release huge amounts of particulate matter into the atmosphere that can affect really large areas. And those areas happen to have really high populations. So you can imagine that the health impacts of those sorts of events can be quite significant. The cost is monumental.
Yes, the Indonesian fires went all the way to Singapore and Malaysia, as I recall. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about the new report, The Rising Threat of Extraordinary Landscape Fires. Our guest is one of the premier wildfire experts, Dr. Andrew Sullivan from CISRO in Australia. So according to the new report, there will be 30% more extreme fires by 2050 because of climate change. Andrew, is it possible for governments to prepare for that?
It's something that they need to prepare for, I think. The first step is understanding what the problem is and how to address it. Now, there's a significant amount of work that's gone into trying to understand the factors that drive the behaviour and occurrence of wildfires. The analysis that was presented in that report is based on more than just climate changes. There's elements in there of the land use change. As I said, there's another factor that influences the risk profile of wildfires. But the important bit is that steps can be done to reduce the propensity for wildfires breaking out and increase the effectiveness of mitigation steps to try to reduce their impact. So that includes things like ignition control measures and fuel management to reduce the intensity of fires, and as well as suppression of fires when they do break out.
When fires strike in developed countries, places like California, people may be helped by insurance or government aid, and some manage to rebuild. But what is the situation in less developed regions where people contribute so little to global warming gases?
It's a major risk in developing countries, and fires have been identified as a major problem in those developing countries to try to reach the development goals. The impact of fire on social, economic, and environmental values in developing countries can have a much longer lasting effect than they would in developed countries. But that being said, the impacts in developed countries can also be quite significant. And as I said earlier, there's no one country in the world that solved the problem. And the solution to those problems isn't a technological solution in and of itself. It needs to be part of a suite of approaches to address the fire problem at all the different intersections in the process. And so that's about communities understanding what their fire risk is, understanding the necessity for steps to be put in place to mitigate fire risk, understanding what the cost of those mitigation steps are, and understanding that there will be a residual risk of fire that they need to be able to deal with. And so that goes everything from the individual householder right up to government. There's a continuous chain of responsibility required to be able to address the increasing threat of wildfires around the world.
In 2013, I interviewed British Columbia silviculturalist John Betts, and John stressed the need to control forest fuels before the superfires develop rather than spending the money after to put them out. And I see this in the UNEP report. Are we misspending some of our money for fire protection?
That's a question to be asked of each individual government. Generally speaking, there is a propensity to wait until the fire starts before money is spent, and that money is generally spent on suppression of that fire. And for the most part, the effort put into suppression when wildfires are burning at their extreme is not going to have much an effect on the behaviour of that fire until the weather starts to moderate. But you can do a lot more before that fire breaks out to manage the fuels and reduce the hazard that is presented by those fuels, such that if a fire was to break out, it'd have a lower probability of being a successful outbreak. And you would increase the effectiveness of the suppression that you did undertake to try to stop that fire when it did start. So there is definitely across the world an imbalance in where investment is, And the recommendation coming out of the report is that there needs to be more money spent in that earlier phase of planning and preparation and reduction of risk before wildfires break out to reduce the impact of those fires. And the impact of those fires is hundreds of orders of magnitude greater than the costs that are spent on managing fires.
This is a big report from the UN, and it's a good summary of the best fire science that we know so far. Does it also look at the impacts on wild animals and plants?
There is a section in the report that looks at that. So the report, as you say, is quite significant. There's more than 50 authors from around the world, more than 37 organisations, and almost 30 countries contributed to that report. And we use case studies from various parts of the world to look at the various impacts that fires have and various steps that different countries have taken to try to address that. One of the case studies looks at the impact of fires on animals and flora and fauna. The complexity that is involved in that, as explained earlier, there's lots of complexity, is that there are many ecosystems around the world that actually require fire to be healthy. So it's not just a matter of excluding fire. The fire needs to be there, but what we need to do is control the sorts of fires that do occur such that ecosystems can continue to function healthily, but they don't have deleterious impacts. And associated with those ecosystems is the fauna involved. As we saw with the 2019-20 fire season in Australia, the sheer extent of those fires meant that many animals had no refuge from the heat of the flames, and the fatalities involved in the animals was quite horrendous in magnitude. So what we need to be able to do is manage the risk of those fires in such a way that animals have refuge and paths of egress out of the path of any fire that does occur to ensure that they've got a way to survive the fire event. And that is very specific to each ecosystem around the world.
And what are you working on now? Just tell us that as we wrap this up.
Well, we've just completed construction of a new lab that houses the Pyrotron that you mentioned earlier, and we're actually next week having a virtual opening of the facility, which is a big focus for me at the moment. But more generally, we're focusing on improving our understanding of various aspects of fire behaviour and refining the fire spread models that we've developed and that are used operationally for predicting the spread of fire across the landscape.
From CISRO in Australia, we've been speaking with wildfire expert Dr. Andrew Sullivan. You can find links to read the new UNEP report, Wildfire, The Rising Threat of Extraordinary Landscape Fires, in my show blog at ecoshock.org and, of course, at unep.org. Andrew, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thanks, Alex. It's my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In case you doubt that we are in a new time of fire, a study in Science Advances is titled U.S. Fires Become Larger, More Frequent, and More Widespread in the 2000s. It was led by Virginia Iglesias. The authors say, quote, "We found compelling evidence that average fire events in regions in the United States are up to four times the size, triple the frequency, and more widespread in the 2000s than in the previous two decades. Moreover, the most extreme fires are also larger, more common, and more likely to co-occur with other extreme fires. This documented shift in burning patterns across most of the country aligns with the palpable change in fire dynamics noted by the media, public, and firefighting officials," end quote. Find a link to that report in my show blog at ecoshock.org, published on Wednesdays. We now see climate change in action. There are so many hot spots and emergencies in living systems. The Arctic is abnormally warm in March 2022. The Svalbard measuring station north of Norway was from 3.9 degrees C to 5.5 degrees C hotter than normal. An early melt is happening. The Arctic sea ice is currently at its fourth lowest state on record. Antarctic sea ice is also very low.
Oh my God, breaking up!
Antarctica. The Washington Post reported March 18th, it's 70 degrees warmer than normal in eastern Antarctica. Scientists are flabbergasted. Jason Salmonow and Dasha Patel write, Antarctic climatology has been rewritten, tweeted Stefano Di Battista, a researcher who has published studies on Antarctic temperatures. He added that such temperature anomalies would have been considered impossible and unthinkable before they actually occurred. End quote from the Post. Three cautions. One, that 70 degrees is Fahrenheit, being around 40 degrees Celsius. Two, that does not mean Antarctica is suddenly melting. For example, temperatures at the High Concordia Research Station would normally be around minus 50 degrees C, but they rose for about 3 days to minus 12 degrees C, still below freezing. Third, the warmth comes from a wet atmospheric river, which may actually add snow to the interior of Antarctica. That could be a good thing because it helps delay melting and may cool Earth a little bit longer. Even so, temperatures in Antarctica rose beyond anything experienced before. Nothing in scientific models showed this as possible. The record-shattering heat in Antarctica again demonstrates we are moving into a new climate beyond human experience and beyond our prediction and imagination. Expect the unexpected. Australian coral experts are investigating yet another major die-off in the Great Barrier Reef, the nursery of the sea. Planes are out measuring to find the extent of what could be the sixth major coral bleaching event, most in the last 10 years. We're watching a life source flickering out because of hot oceans, because of our emissions.
It's a sense of loss. You know, I mean, your future is very uncertain. You know that you're up against one of the most powerful industries in the world. And the industry and the state and federal governments, they're just looking for the money. Mm. And unfortunately, the human cost is not on their agenda.
In the new carbon-charged world, you are listening to Radio EcoShock, broadcast around the world on radio and the Internet. Find Radio EcoShock on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, the weekly show blog, ecoshock.org. Tune in. Turn on. Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith makes YouTube videos explaining the latest science and reports on climate change. His specialty is the Arctic, but Paul surveys science all over the world. In mid-March, he caught up with a report from the British institution called Chatham House. You may have heard of Chatham House rules. People meet in groups, but they're never named. They have an organization with staff. Four of their staff released a report in September 2021 called Climate Change Risks 2021. Their subhead says, the risks are compounding, and without immediate action, the impacts will be devastating, end quote. I'm going to read you some of the highlight quotes from that report. Here we go. Any relapse or stasis in emissions reduction policies could lead to a plausible worst case of 7 degrees C of warming by the end of the century, 10% chance, says Chatham House report. Unless NDCs, the nationally determined contributions under the Paris Accord, are dramatically increased and policy and delivery mechanisms are revised, many of the impacts described in this research paper are likely to be locked in by 2040 and become so severe they go beyond the limits of what nations can adapt to. If emissions do not come down drastically before 2030, then by 2040, some 3.9 billion people are likely to experience major heat waves, 12 times more than the historic average. By the 2030s, 400 million people globally each year are likely to be exposed to temperatures exceeding the workability threshold. Also by the 2030s, the number of people on the planet exposed to heat stress exceeding the survivability threshold is likely to surpass 10 million a year. To meet global demand, agriculture will need to produce almost 50% more food by 2050. However, yields could decline by 30% in the absence of dramatic emissions reductions. By 2040, the average proportion of global cropland affected by severe drought will likely rise to 32% a year, more than three times the historic average. That is from the Chatham House report, called Climate Change Risks 2021. I will put a link in my blog at ecoshock.org. Last week, the world lost a great campaigner. I first met Lafcadio Cortizi when he was a forest campaigner for Greenpeace International in the early 1990s. He was born an American, a fan of the Grateful Dead. Lafcadio moved with his young family to Indonesia. He adopted Indonesian dress and learned to speak the language of Bahasa. Lafcadio loved the jungles, jungle creatures, from Sumatra through Borneo to Papua New Guinea. Cortizi worked tirelessly to save those forests for Rainforest Action Network, Forest Ethics, and most recently for the Canadian-based organization Canopy. He was an irrepressible force. Lafcadio loved to laugh, to dance, to infect people with joy. Everyone knew when Lafcadio was not just in the room, but in the building. Without any signs of illness, in his late 50s, Lafcadio went to bed and passed in his sleep. It is a complete shock to his family, his workmates, and everyone who knew him. There is a Facebook page in memory of Lafcadio Cortizi. It rapidly filled up with photos and memories from environmentalists all over the world, many inspired by him. Rest in peace, friend. At this time, the war in Ukraine continues its pitiless pace of destruction, both of lives and property. While North Americans pull off the masks and party, it's the end of the pandemic. But a new wave is just beginning in China. South Korea, so admired for its control of the virus in 2020, just reported over 600,000 new cases in a single day. Virus death rates in Hong Kong are the highest in the world. This is mostly the super transmitter variation called BA2. It can reinfect people who had previous versions of COVID. Fortunately, we know a new virus in China could never spread to the rest of the world. Oh, wait. There are no special controls on planes coming in from Asia. Most countries have dropped testing requirements for entry. Global trade continues. The virus is increasing and increasing in Europe and especially in Great Britain. Of course another wave will come. There are millions of people still unvaccinated, and all vaccine protection is beginning to wane. Seniors need a fourth shot. We are letting our guard down, even as the enemy approaches. As you heard in this program, and almost every week on Radio EcoShock, the grand long-term threat and immediate source of more crisis is climate change. Through war, economic troubles, starvation, or plagues, we just keep burning fossil fuels and tearing down nature. We could still put out the fossil fire before it consumes our only home. Let's do that. Stop exploring for more oil and gas. Stop your governments allowing that. Stop financing coal and close that industry down. Slash your own energy use and expectations. Demand action from governments at every level, including the local. Join and support climate action groups. Show your strength, and most of all, believe that we can. I'm Alex Smith. A real thank you for listening and caring about this world.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
World Violinists for Ukraine.
Dear